Good evening and welcome to the August 8th, 2016 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission meeting. Welcome everyone. Our first order of business this evening is the introduction of our newest health commissioner. Seated directly to my left, we have Tamar Sakayan, who is a native of San Luis Obispo County, having been born in our very own San Luis County Health Hospital. She attended both UC Santa Barbara and Boston University, and has served as a foreign policy intern in the office of Senator Edward Kennedy. She has come home to San Luis to raise her family and wishes to be an active advocate for her community. She has a special interest in public health concerns such as domestic violence, elder abuse, child abuse, and oncology. We are happy to have her serve as one of our consumer representatives and welcome her this evening. Next, we need to approve our minutes from the last couple of meetings, actually, our June 13, 2016 meeting. Jean has sent out the minutes to everyone. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes that need to be made to that meeting's minutes? If not, they will be approved as presented and will be published on the website. We also need to approve the minutes of our retreat meeting, which was July 18th, 2016. Anybody have any additions, corrections, or changes to those? There were several additional handouts that came with those minutes. Our meeting dates for the next year or so, our commissioner roster, and also our committee liaison appointments. I think we do have one update to that, actually. Commissioner Smith Cook has agreed to be our representative on the Oral Health Commission. Correct, Scott? So we can update that. So those will also be approved as presented and published on the website. At this time, we are open for public comment. This public comment period is an invitation to members of the community to present issues, thoughts, or suggestions on matters that are not scheduled on our agenda this evening, but are within the scope of the interest of the Health Commission. Do we have any public comment? Okay. If you have public comment, please step forward to one of the podiums. Before you begin, please give us your name.
Do I push a button? Oh, there we go. Okay. Good evening. I'm Rochelle Toady, and I was here a couple of months ago, and I had requested that you agendize the health issue of the air pollution on the Napomo Mesa, and I wanted to thank you for doing so, and including the APCD report, which we're going to have tonight. I think that's a good first step, as their data confirms our concerns about exposure levels. As I previously stated, this is a public health issue which needs to be effectively addressed on numerous levels. Earlier today, I sent a letter, which hopefully you received copies of, but I've given copies to Jean, with some proposed possible actions. And I also wanted to say that I hope at a future date there will be an opportunity for concerned citizens like myself to share our perspectives of what's happened so far on this issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So remember, public comment is for issues not on this evening's agenda. Sir.
Good evening. My name is John Kress. I live at 2530 Laurie Way in Arroyo Grande. I'm in the main dust zone. We've had several dust storms, like you see on television, coming out of Phoenix, where visibility is down to about 300 feet. The dust cloud that's coming in off the dunes is approximately 300 feet high. Two years ago, I had a problem with my right eye. Went to the ophthalmologist, had an MRI done. He couldn't find anything, but referred me to a neurologist here in San Luis Obispo. And the neurologist concluded that the problem with my eye was going off on a tangent all by itself. And what she found was that I've had several mini strokes. And she could not find anything in my health history that would have contributed to it. Subsequently, somebody forwarded me this report from Harvard talking about fine particle air pollution. And I don't know if that's caused the problem, but there is definitely a problem out where we live. And if anybody wants to come out to my house, I can let them see my front porch, see my car, feel the abrasive particles that come floating down in the air. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you for your comments. We will, at this time, go ahead and go into our agenda for the evening. And I will ask Commissioner Smith Cook to introduce our first presentation.
Great, thank you very much. Janice Gamble, if you'd be willing to come up to the podium. As she does, I must say I've had a wonderful experience in visiting her office. This is from the Ag Commissioner's office, and Commissioner Klaus and I both have joined her a couple times this year, as we did, I believe, 2 years ago. And learned all about pesticide use in our county and the enforcement of that permitting. I learned so much, I think I might want to be one of their employees, but I have retired from my career life, so I'll let it go. But it is really wonderful to be able to have Janice here. She's got many decades of having experiences this, and is currently our Deputy Agricultural Commissioner, and I'm going to turn it over to her to tell more about her department and what you've been doing.
Thank you. As Scott said, I am the Deputy Ag Commissioner for the Ag Department, and I've been managing the Pesticide Use Enforcement Program for about the last 13 years, and I've been with the department for much longer than that, but we won't talk about that right now. I mainly want to talk about the Pesticide Use Enforcement Program. Every couple of years, we come to you, and we like to tell you what we do, and also to hopefully allay some concerns that are out there in the public about pesticide use in San Luis Obispo County. Our mission is to protect people and the environment from the misuse of pesticides, and we do that by enforcing the laws and regulations. So we don't make up the laws and regulations, but we do enforce them. Today, I'm going to talk about a little bit of the history, our program with your commission, because I see a lot of new faces up there. And then I will talk about a couple of the hot topics that are going on in the county, as well as some future challenges for our department and the program in particular. So back in 1998, our relationship with the Health Commission pretty much began. We had a very concerned citizens down in the Arroyo Grande area that were living in a neighborhood close to an agricultural field, and there were lots of complaints and concerns about health, about whether the pesticides that were being applied were being applied safely. And that spurred a whole bunch of meetings. We ended up having a pesticide task force that met for over 2 years. I participated on that task force with many stakeholders. They represented the agriculture industry as well as health department. We had a doctor, he was from the public health department who was on our committee. And we talked a lot about pesticide hazards, and it was really an educational process. At the end of the task force, there were some recommendations that were formed, and I won't go into those because there were quite a few, but most of them focused on communication, and that's why it's been so good that we've been able to continue to come to you on a regular basis to give you an update about what our program is about and what we do, so that when you do get concerns about pesticide use, you know who to call, that our department really does deal with those concerns. We don't deal with health concerns. We deal with the legal use. If there are health concerns, then we actually refer those to your doctor or to the health department. So I've been coming about every other year for many years. And we are very committed to continue to come and to provide updates to you so that you know what we're doing and what the big issues are. And if you want more details about the whole history, I'd be happy to talk to you about them. You know, give me a call. We have to actually start with what we do to regulate the use of pesticides. Like I said earlier, we don't make the rules. We pretty much work under the umbrella of the US EPA, the federal laws, and also the state laws. That's the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And they do a lot of work to make sure that pesticides, when they're labeled in a way that will protect people and the environment. So that's the very place that we start, is with label compliance. If people follow the labels, there is a measure of safety in doing that. And then on top of the labels, there's also additional regulations that are in California. We have the strictest regulations in the whole nation, really, on how we regulate the use of pesticides. And then some pesticides are classified as restricted materials. For those materials, then we at the Ag Department, we have authority to evaluate the site and evaluate the use, and we issue permits to people to protect people and the environment. So we will go beyond what's on the label sometimes. We will go beyond what's in regulation at times for the use of those more hazardous materials, those restricted materials. So we've been dealing with a couple of hot topics over the years. One is pesticide use near schools, and then another one is field fumigant use. I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about those. The use of pesticides around schools is of great concern to everybody. You know, whether you work in agriculture or you're a teacher or you have children, you might be concerned about pesticides used near your school, your children, while they're in school. So schools have always been designated as a sensitive site by our office. And when our inspectors issue permits to applicators to apply pesticides, we take extra precautions for those locations. There's a couple or several different rules that come into play. When schools use pesticides on their own property, then they need to follow the Healthy Schools Act, and there's lots of notification related to letting parents know what's being used there. And then for those adjacent properties, that's really more where we get involved. So if a grower wants to apply pesticides next to a school, if they're using general use pesticides that are not restricted, we don't really have authority to tell them to do something different, but we do make lots of recommendations to growers who are near schools. Sometimes they'll add extra buffer zones, or they'll make applications when the students are not present, which is all very helpful. And there is a lot that goes on with growers nearby doing voluntary things. But when the restricted use pesticides are used, then we absolutely go in and we make extra recommendations, and we tell them, you know, you're going to have to add a buffer zone here, or you can only make applications at these times. So there has been in the press, the last, probably since 2010, an even greater emphasis or concern about pesticide use around schools, especially in some of our neighboring counties. You may have read or heard about Monterey or Ventura County having very concerned citizens in those counties. So our department decided 2 years ago to do a focused activity. So what we did was we wanted to ground truth assumptions about pesticides and where they're used around schools. And so we looked at all of the restricted materials they have to turn in a notice of intent to us before they even apply, 24 hours before they apply those materials. And even when they're getting their permits, we are providing extra precautions. So they have permit conditions that they have to follow to use those restricted materials. So when we get those notice of intents, our inspectors look at a GIS layer that we have of all the schools, and we see, are there any schools within a quarter mile of that application? And they're targeting those inspections. So we have about 67 schools that come within a quarter mile of an agriculture area, which could be a park, it could be a golf course, or it could be more of an industrial setting. We have a layer that the inspectors go to, and they look at the schools, and if it does trigger in, then they have a goal of trying to get as many of those applications inspected as possible. So this one is Los Ranchos School. There is some ag fields near there. So in 2014-15, we recorded all of the applications that were restricted materials within a quarter mile of a school, and these are the results. 21 applications were happening within a quarter mile of school. That made up 8 campuses. So that meant that some of the applications were multiple applications near the same school. We conducted 13 pre-application inspections, meaning that the day before the application was to take place, we went out and we looked, and we ground truthed it all the day before. And then 5 of those applications, we actually watched the application take place. The good news is that there were no violations observed, and we have a lot of criteria that we check into, and Commissioners Klaus and Smith Cook can attest to that. So we look at a lot of things, and there were no violations, and all the applications took place at night or when the children were not present. We gathered the same data for this past year in 15-16. It was similar results. You can see we had less applications near schools in 15-16. And we were able to do more pre-application and application inspections. So we're feeling very confident that in San Luis Obispo County, the applications that are next to schools with restricted materials are being done mostly when children are not present. So that's very good news for our children in San Luis Obispo County. The Department of Pesticide Regulation, our state department, is in the process of creating some new regulations because this is such of a concern statewide. And you can go to the website and see what's under development. They expect to have some new rules related to using pesticides near schools within the next year. And these are some of the concepts that they're looking at. Some of it has to do with notification, letting schools know when applications are going to be taking place. And some of it has to do with changing either methods or materials in those locations. These rules have not been out yet, so they're going to put together a proposed regulation package. And then there'll be lots of public comment. And then eventually we'll have some new regulations around schools to provide some extra protection. The next area I want to talk about as far as a topic is field fumigants. Back in 2005, this was one of the grand jury concerns, was about the use of methyl bromide. Methyl bromide was supposed to be phased out in 2005, but there wasn't a good replacement for it. So the government kept allowing for critical use exemptions for crops like strawberries. So we continued to be able to use the material, but all of the methyl bromide is going to be gone after next year. At any rate, the fumigants they're the most toxic materials that we do regulate. They have the most requirements. Every time somebody wants to make a fumigant application with these restricted materials. They have to bring in a work site plan. They usually sit down with us, with the pest control advisor and the grower, and they are given lots of requirements around those sites. And then our office has made it a very high priority. So we go out and do as many of those inspections as possible. So every time we have a notice of intent, and those we get 48-hour notice on, plus we do all this work on the worksite plan, then we go out and do pre-application and application site inspections, and we do a lot of those. These are the common field fumigants that are used in San Luis Obispo County, mostly on strawberries. And this is a graph of some of the different fumigants that are used. And you can see the blue, that's 1,3-D. That's one of the things that they're trying to use as a substitute for methyl bromide. The green line is the methyl bromide, and you can see that the use has been decreasing over time. This is the number of acres treated with that material. The red is 100% chloropicrin. That's the material that's used in a lot of these. It used to be a warning agent or a tear gas, but now they're also using it for its pesticidal properties. And it's becoming more and more popular by the growers to be used. And then they're also using metam potassium or metam sodium, which is a new use. So the growers are looking for alternatives to methyl bromide. This kind of shows it in a different way. You can see that the acreage in San Luis Obispo County back in 2005 was a little over 500 acres total for strawberries planted. And then in 2015, it was close to 3,500 acres. So it's a big difference. We've had quite a growth, a lot of conversion of our vegetable crops in our South County to strawberries. And this also represents a big increase in our workload because we've been dealing with these more complicated requirements. These are some of the requirements that we've been working with growers on. Some of them I've mentioned before: neighbor notification, site monitoring, buffer zones. This is just the tip of the iceberg when we're dealing with growers on these sites. This is just an example of a site plan where the inspector sits down and looks at maps and identifies where the wellheads are. They would look at where the bus stops are, and they do a very thorough evaluation of the site before they allow the permitting of these materials. Almost all of the fumigants that are used in our county are under tarps. This is a drip method. This is commonly used in our county. And then there's also a flat fume method, but this is not used as often, and that's probably good because these, you'll notice they have to glue them together and they lay flat on the field. So there's more hazard of them potentially blowing off. But we don't have this type of application as often as the drip. The tarp selection is extremely important for these jobs, and over the last year, DPR has developed a California-approved list so growers can get reductions in their buffer zone distance. The label has a buffer zone distance, and if they use the special tarps, they can reduce the buffer zones, which is a good thing both for the neighbors. They know they've tested it and through air monitoring, and they know that these tarps are keeping the gas in better. We have always, since we've allowed the 100% chloropicrin, we've always required these higher barrier tarps. And now in 2017, we're going to require the high barrier tarps for all applications of any product that has chloropicrin on it. And the reasons are because there's less off-gassing, there's smaller buffer zones, they're much easier to for us to regulate when the buffer zones are smaller. We are, for 2016, some of these products that have chloropicrin in it, we're still allowing the standard tarp. And the reason we're allowing the standard tarp is because many of the growers have already invested in their tarps. And for us to all of a sudden change the rules and say, okay, well, you can't use that tarp anymore, you have to use this one, wouldn't be very fair to them, as long as we're providing that measure of safety that's needed. So those standard tarps have bigger buffer zones, and we work really closely with them to maybe decrease the size of the treatment area so that both the buffer zones don't get too big. So this is something that we're going to be doing in 2017. I could get a drink of water. Okay, some of our future challenges. We're currently in the process of testing this California Pesticide Activities Tracking System, and that is a tablet that our inspectors are going to have. So we're no longer going to have paper and pencil inspection forms like we've had forever. Now we're going to have tablets that they're going to be able to use in the field. They'll be able to see the code sections, bring that information up. They'll be able to see if they're looking at a pest control business that works in multiple counties. They'll be able to see what their enforcement history is statewide, as well as they will be able to see that GIS layer of where schools are, and that's also being developed on a statewide basis. So that's going to be really handy. This is going to be a real big game changer for our department. We haven't had tablets. So it's going to be a learning curve, and we're going to be getting those in November of this year. So all of our staff are going to be learning how to do inspections. It's the same inspection, just a different tool. So it's kind of exciting. Another area of challenge in the future is the legalized marijuana grows. So, you know, as you know, we regulate the use of pesticides. If marijuana is legal in California, then we'll be regulating the use of pesticides on a whole new crop. And right now, there's not a lot of pesticides that are registered for marijuana. So we'll be working very closely with the federal government and with the state government to make sure that whatever is used is safe and that it's used properly. I'm almost done, and then we'll do some questions. And then one other challenge for us is just all the baby boomer retirements. We've had a lot of turnover. We're continuing to have that turnover, and it's going to continue into the future. Last year, I think we had 4 people retire. The year before that, we had 5. And so we're in the process of trying to do more cross-training. And so that's why I'm no longer going to be the deputy for the Pesticide Use Enforcement Program. I'm moving on to the Pest Exclusion Program. And what that'll do is provide our department with a little more depth. When one person leaves, it doesn't create a vacuum, and we can all help each other into the future. So that is a big challenge for us. I always want to close on who do you call if you have concerns about pesticide exposure questions. These are great resources. We often point people in the direction of that National Pesticide Information Center. It's open 24/7. It's also got a great website, and they will answer questions about concerns. If you know what pesticide that you have a concern about, you just call them and ask them, and they'll be answer those questions. We also do suggest that you talk to your doctor if you have other health concerns too. And then if you're concerned about the misuse of pesticides, of course, we're the agency that regulates the use of pesticides. So if you see something that looks funny and you don't think it's legal, call us. We want as much information as possible. We're required to investigate every single complaint that we get. And Commissioner Klaus and Commissioner Smith-Cook can tell you that we do lots of investigations of complaints. And we do also get information from when somebody has an illness and they go to the doctor or they go to the hospital, then we get that information. We also investigate those cases as well. So that concludes my update. So do you have any questions?
Thank you, Janice.
we'll ask Jean to send out your handout to all the commissioners after this evening's meeting. And let's start with Commissioner Warren for questions.
Thank you. Good presentation, and this is far different than it was 20 years ago.
Oh, yes.
Okay, my first one is, what about medical marijuana grows? Are you guys inspecting those at all for people that have X number of plants in their backyard? Because I know there's been a lot of problems with the neighbors and smell and everything else, and Lord knows what pesticides they're using.
Yeah, if we get a complaint about pesticide use on any kind of home use or any kind of pesticide use, we'll look into it. But we're not right now going... We will probably be focusing most of our... efforts on commercial production of a crop. So it's considered home use or for this personal use, medical marijuana, it kind of falls out of, you know, that's not like, we're not, the home user does not need to come into us to get an operator identification number or a permit to apply pesticides. Once it becomes a commercial crop, then all agricultural producers have to come to our office and get a permit or an OIN. So it really comes down to the label for those home use, and if someone has a concern, they can call us and we can look into it.
Okay. My other question is about regulating the pesticides that come in into our food here from, say, Mexico and South American countries that might be using some of these other same pesticides, and how's that regulated? And then same thing with outside vendors that might come in from out of the county to our farmers markets.
Right. At the state level, the California Department of Pesticide Regulation has a program where they do sampling in the marketplace. And they go to many places, including some farmers markets, to test produce for residues. And then if they find a residue that's over the legal tolerance, then they report those to us and we do an investigation. And we do probably one or two of those a year. But a lot of the produce that's coming from out of country, if you look at the statistics on the Department of Pesticide website, a lot of the stuff that's grown in California is really pretty clean compared to some of those things that are coming from out of country. So I'd encourage you to go ahead and look at the statistics on that. It's just something to be aware of as a consumer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. That's just awesome, your presentation there. Just as a reminder again, Commissioner Klaus and I did meet with Janice in her office and one of her staff members. It's obvious when we're there that they have excellent relationships with the Ag Commission and the community. Excuse me, not Ag Commission, Ag Industry. They have great relationships. And I specifically was reviewing their complaint logs. And you know, those complaint logs reflect they call everybody back. Even when some of those complaints look so unfounded, they're calling the wrong office, they always get callbacks. And I noticed her office is quite happy to do that and educate the public too. So impressed that way with what I saw. Commissioner Klaus and I will be updating this commission at our next meeting about our review of the Ag Commission's office, their activities, interviews we had with Janice and staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Again, thank you, Janice. Good presentation. Our next agenda item this evening, we have Gary Willey, who's with Engineering and Compliance Division, and he's the manager of that division, actually, from our Air Pollution Control District, and he's going to give us an update on the South County Air Quality and Dunes Dust Rule implementation. Welcome, Gary.
Good morning, Commissioners. Gary Willey, Air Pollution Control District Engineering and Compliance Manager. Can we cue up my PowerPoint? Well, this dunes issue has been a long haul for us. And I don't know how Well, you've all been following it, but you have to know about it because it's everywhere. I'm going to go over a lot of stuff in short order, and stop me if you have a question on it. Be more than happy to go over any of it or answer any types of questions. Okay, so the Oceano Dunes, I know you're all probably aware of it, but it's 7.4 miles of coastline. 1,600 acres are open to off-highway riding, and there's probably 4,000 acres. The land is owned by state parks, the County of San Luis Obispo, and Phillips 66. So the county, excuse me, I want the wrong button here. The county actually owns the La Grande track, this area in here, and it is probably the highest active riding area. The county owns it and leases it to state parks. ConocoPhillips property is down in this area. It's also leased to state parks. A big issue with it and what causes the dust to blow is the northwest winds that are just set up and predominantly in the springtime. And we do also have it in the fall as well. Okay, so this is the only beach in California that you can drive on. 2 million visitors days. That's not 2 million visitors, that's person day visits. So if every person, if you were there a week, you have 7 person days. Over 325,000 street legal vehicles travel on the beach each year, and 200,000 off-highway vehicles. The heavy holiday weekends see 15 to 20,000 visitors per day. Quite a lot. When I was younger going there, there wasn't nearly as many vehicles there because we were basically in dune buggies and things like that. They're, as I've grown up and watched them go, it's changed quite a lot. The number of vehicles traveling on there is a lot more, and the area is a lot more compact. It used to be spread out, which it leads to some of the issues that we have. It's so compact at this point. So we've been monitoring on the Mesa for over 20 years. We started picking up that it was significantly more PM10 than other areas in the county. We have between 60 and 80 state air quality exceedances a year on the Mesa, and anywhere from 0 to 3 federal exceedances on the Mesa. They're different air standards. The federal standard is much less stringent. PM10 is rarely exceeded anywhere else in the county. Usually it's due to a wildfire or smoke from wood burning in the winter. And what's of the biggest concern health-wise is the relative magnitude of the high spikes of the dust emissions. So the annual or the daily standard is 24 or 50 micrograms per meter cubed on a 24-hour standard. During the peak times in the day, in the springtime, it can be, in 1 hour, it could be 200 to 600. The reason why that's important is because that's when you're active. So a daily standard is based upon an average throughout the day, but at nighttime, you're not processing nearly as much air. So if you're breathing hard, you're taking in more of it, so your exposure rate is higher. Here's a graph of the county-wide PM10 levels, and if you look on it, the CDF site's up top, and that's right in the center of the dust plume. The Mesa 2 site is next, and that's a little further south of the main part of the dust plume. And then Napomo Regional Park, which is in the interior, in line with the dunes, but quite a ways inland. And you can notice that the number of exceedances for other areas in the county are very low compared to the CDF site, which is our main monitoring site there. What's of interest is this downward trend, and that we've seen less winds in the past 3 years. We haven't had as high a peak winds. So we've done some work out there with state parks. We're unsure of the effectiveness of the temporary work we've done because the winds have dropped so much in the past 2 years. So meteorologically speaking, there's not a lot of conclusions we can do on our temporary fixes that we put out there. It's another graph showing the peak hourly concentrations. And you can see that Atascadero is down on this line. And then this is the CDF site as compared to particulates in Atascadero. That's on one of our highest days, up to 600 micrograms per meter cube. And that's just as bad as a really bad day in Beijing. It's another graph on peak levels, and you can see this is a November time period where we have a mini spring condition in the fall. Typically, we'll get a few weeks where we'll get an episode. So if you look at November 10th in 2010, you can see the background's fairly low. The winds start to pick up on a three-day event, get higher, and then they start to trail off. And it's a typical event. Here's an aerial view of the dust plume. You can see that it rises right through this area, almost on the edge of the bluff coming out of the main riding area. We did an extensive study in 2012 where we put out 20 plus monitors on there are these, excuse me, rookie on this clicker. So each of these purple dots is a monitor that we saturated the community with to get an idea of how we're gonna map this plume and where it's coming from and the levels of dust that are there. The results are shown here. With the green being the highest density, and then tailing off as you get further inland as it drops and north of the riding area where it's really pretty close to the same as San Luis Obispo. State Parks has conducted some of their own studies after our studies. And I don't know how my slides got a little out of order, but so on this side, this is a state park study of actual the emissions on the sand, how where the higher emissive areas are. So they did these different transects. They have a device that they set on the sand that mimics wind speed, and then they measure the dust emissions based upon that. And what they found was similar to what we found with our monitors, that the main riding area in the La Grande track, which is county property, the emission level as wind speed picks up is much higher when compared to areas where you don't ride. And that's the Dune Preserve, Oso Flaco area, and other areas. And these are bare sand emissions, so it's they're actually set in device on top of the sand, so it's not in brush or anything like that. A timeline, we started pretty much this whole process in 2007 with our phase one study. That we just said, well, let's look at all the sources that are out there. It could be ag roads, could be agricultural processes. And it pointed to the dunes area. So then we did a second study in 2010 called a phase two study. And that kind of quantified or located the areas on the SVRA that we're emitting. And then in 2011, November, we adopted a regulation to require mitigation out there. I went over the community monitoring project that developed that plume path. I showed you that. In March of 2013, we entered into an agreement with state parks called the consent decree agreement. And that basically ended some litigation that we had with state parks, and we've been working through this consent decree agreement process since that time. I showed you the, talked about the studies that the OHV, that's off-highway motor vehicle, that they put out, and their emissions that basically backed up what our studies had showed. In 2013, also in 2013, the State Air Resources Board started helping us moderate the process and providing a vehicle for the two groups to meet and get together on using their technical expertise as well. In April 2014 was the first year of temporary mitigation on the dunes, mostly sand fencing and hay bales. In 2015, we took the data that we had from 2014 and modified the temporary mitigation. And in 2015, we also sited our control area monitor, control site monitor. And that's, our regulation requires that the OHV area emit at the same rate as a natural background area. And so the control site monitor is the reference point. And so that's just south of Oso Flaco Lake in the dunes. That's been gathered, that's been giving us data now for over a year. And this year, in spring of 16, we had another cycle of mitigation, basically temporary sand fencing and some other porous roughness elements, which is basically a screen box, fancy name for a screen box. Right now, a draft EIR for permanent mitigation is being circulated, and State Parks has just released that last week. We're currently also working on some 3D atmospheric modeling. ARB, the Air Resources Board, is generating this complicated model. And when it's done, they're going to let us run it. So exciting, something we haven't seen for a community of our size to have somebody run a three-dimensional atmospheric model for us. So I talked about how we operated right now and how we're going forward with mitigation. And the consent decree process is how we're implementing the rule, and it has a dispute resolution process. It ended the litigation between State Parks and APCD. It provides an ongoing structure for us and has a special master provision, which if we did run into a situation where we couldn't agree on something, we have an expert from Ontario, Canada in dunes mitigation to help us. There's also a technical team, and the technical team is the Air Resources Board, the Air District, and State Parks, and their consultants. And so we're all looking at things and coming to an agreement on you know, how we should move forward and what the data means. It's a little shot of what the temporary mitigation is right now, and it's this is sand fencing. So you can see the distance between these areas. If you look at the first area, this is full of sand. It catches the first wave. The next one has a little more sand, and by the time you get three back, there's not much sand between them because it stopped the movement of the sand, which is the primary way the emissions are generated. It's the sand moves sooner in the riding area at a lower wind speed than in the non-riding area. So we get more dust emissions because the sand moves first, even without vehicles on it. So it's not an issue of emissions coming off the vehicles themselves. The issue is the sand from the disturbed areas moves at lower wind speeds, even when there's nobody on it. As I spoke a little bit about the current work that's underway, the 3D atmospheric modeling, we've been evaluating the data from the 2014 through 2016 mitigation on basically sand fencing and some other porous roughness elements or things that stick up in the wind. We're developing criteria for measuring the progress. In other words, what are we going forward? Is it working? The EIR for the five-year plan, which is supposed to be designed to get us to meet the requirements of the rule and to reduce the health impact. After that EIR has been circulated and approved by State Parks, then it has to go to the Coastal Commission through another round. We have to develop mitigation for our 2017 based upon the data that we have now and the five-year plan. It's not likely that we get Coastal Commission approval before 2017 wind season, which is March, so we're probably going on another temporary plan for the following year. In summary, progress is much slower than we planned, but we're progressing. So right now, I have the most hope of forward progress that I have in the past 5 years on it, which is really good. It's been complicated by lawsuits. We've had five filed on us. The county has a lawsuit filed on them. State Parks is involved in a couple still. The Coastal Commission is involved in a lawsuit on it as well. We've spent over $1.8 million on conducting studies and including paying $370,000 in legal fees. That doesn't even mention all the staff time that we've put out. We've spent much more than that. Like I said, the graph is showing that we had fewer exceedances, which is really good for health in the past 3 years. However, it's inconclusive on the effectiveness because of the lower wind speed. So yeah, it's in the noise of the statistics on whether or not the temporary stuff is that effective. We can't say that it is or it isn't, but we can say that the number of exceedance days has dropped. We're roughly the same this year as we were last year at this time. I think we've had 48 exceedances of the state standard. It's not near the 80. Based upon typical wind patterns in the fall, we'll probably get another 12 exceedances or similar to there and be right where we were last year or close enough. The Air District and State Parks are moving forward. It's a very complicated process. I'm sure you're going to see a lot more of it in the news. If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to do so. I know it's a lot.
Thanks, Gary. Questions? Starting down, Scott, do you have anything?
Sure. Thank you. Would you mind going back in your slide to the one that was the pictorial showing the plume going over?
Okay.
Yeah.
That one?
My screen's so small here, I have a smaller one than the rest of us. So can you kind of help me get my bearing? You pointed again with your red marker there. Yeah, that's okay. It going. And what is south of this? I assume south is towards me.
That's south. Yeah, this is the north side.
Okay.
Okay, that's the north side. Mm-hmm. So that's coming off the riding area, the edge of the riding area.
Oh, okay.
So it's traveling that way, right at our CDF site somewhere in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's traveling basically along the that side of the mesa.
Okay, yeah. And what's this population area I'm seeing here? Is this Arroyo Grande?
I think this is Black Lake.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the golf course?
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I was trying to get my bearing and picture what this is like.
Cypress Ridge.
Yeah, it's Cypress Ridge, my mistake.
Okay.
Because Black Lake's over there.
So the very bottom of this slide, what would that be right there? What's that road there? I'm just trying to get my geographic bearings.
No, it's getting close towards the freeway, but okay. We're not there yet. Los Barros Road,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The freeway should be down on there somewhere.
Gotcha. Okay. That's really helpful.
So the bottom of the slide is more like the freeway area.
Yeah.
If you were just off the bottom.
I'll turn it back for questions.
Oh, yeah, I certainly appreciate that this is a complicated issue, but for the people that live in there that are being exposed to the silicone dust, what do you tell them that it's taken 5 years to do anything? I mean, I know you've done lots of studies and spent lots of money, but how do you satisfy the people that are concerned with their health because of this silicone dust?
I really don't have a good answer for that, other than this this process, it gets slowed legally, and it just, it, there's a lot of air quality issues, like with coal-fired power plants and other areas that you get caught in lawsuits and you're not, you can't move quickly. You just legally, you can't move. Right. So that's one of the big issues we have right now.
Okay. Okay. That's all I have.
Thanks for your time today. Just a question around public health awareness. So when there are days where standards are being exponentially exceeded, is there anything to do that can be done in terms of letting the public know on in terms of air quality and on those days?
We have electronic noticing available. You go on our website and look at it. So we do send out alerts on that, and Dr. Borenstein's involved in those as well. We do have an extensive notification system for that. So with the winds blowing in there, if the wind's blowing hard in the Pomo Mesa, there's going to be an extensive amount of dust. So pretty much if you had a wind gauge in your backyard and it's blowing 20 miles an hour or more, there's going to be an issue.
And what are the current recommendations for residents that are living there in terms of precautions that they should take or can take?
Yeah, it's pretty much, avoid outdoor activities. So it's...
Okay. It's basic, huh?
Yeah.
Got it.
Commissioner Sakine, if I could add a little bit to that, what Mr. Violet really was saying is true that you can go onto a website and get information on a daily basis, but a number of the residents have proactively signed up for something called EnviroFlash so that they don't have to go and look for the information. It comes directly by either email or, I'm not sure if text is an option.
Text
but
message?
Email.
Tweet? Is it a tweet?
The information also gets, KSBY has partnered with APCD to print that information as well, I think, as the Tribune. And there has been a program developed with the schools, a flag system, color-coded to on days that there are going to be exceedances to alert families in a more macro way.
Thank you.
There's also some real-time data out there that you can access via the Air Resources Board website. It's not quite real time. It's probably an hour behind, but it's available.
Thank you.
Moving to my right, Chris.
You know, this probably is a really dumb question, but we're the only county in California that has dunes that are being driven on. Right. So
only coastal dunes.
Ones. Is that for a reason?
I think it's for many reasons.
Can you enlighten me? Maybe what some of the more obvious ones are.
The plants and wildlife can't survive when you ride on them. So. That's one of a lot of them, I think, have been shut down for those reasons. When I was younger, you could ride on the sand spit in Morro Bay. I'm sure you could ride in other areas of the state. I'm not aware of it, but I'm just aware of the acreage in South County and Morro Strand area where you could ride on the beach. You know, you ride your cars or sand buggies or whatever.
And how does the particulates for the exceedance for this area compare with other areas that have windy circumstances?
Coastally, it's the highest of any coastal area by far.
Okay.
There are areas in the Owens Lake that's far higher. Mm-hmm. From Los Angeles Department of Water and Power draining that
but
lake.
But for coastal, it's higher.
Yeah, for coastal, it's the only place that has this issue. So.
Okay. And we really don't have any comparison of what it would be without the vehicles?
No.
Okay.
We have, not that for that particular area, we have comparisons about other areas of bare sand adjacent to the riding, either north or south, that emit at much lower levels. We have that, but no one's ever shut down the riding there and measured the difference, no.
Okay. And then if I understand the data, 2013, there was about a 50% or close to 50% drop. Since 2013?
There has been a drop from about 80 to 60.
To 60.
Yeah,
okay.
So roughly a 25% drop, but then we've seen a lot lower winds.
Okay.
So the analysis that we did on that was, we can't tell if that was...
But you've also done some things to try and mitigate, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So I showed you the sand fencing features there. They have planted some vegetation, but it's outside of the riding areas where the emissivity or the amount of emissions is quite lower to begin with. So not the best place for it.
Okay.
But the sand fencing is the biggest temporary mitigation that we have out there. And that's about 40 acres of the 1,600 acres that are out there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just had one comment. That picture that Scott had you bring up, that is the mesa.
Yes.
That we were looking at.
Yes.
Because I remember many years ago, that was nothing but eucalyptus trees up there. Not a lot of, and a few salvage yards and things as you drove through. So a lot of this development has happened in the last 25 years.
Yes, it has.
And I think we don't always look at that. It's always been a windy knob up there, but you had the trees to break it. And now you've got all this development, including golf courses, and we've done away with the trees that were providing a lot of the screening. And that's just my comment on it. You mentioned that the environmental impact report is out for people to take a look at, and how would they find that?
You could go on to the state parks. OHV website. I don't have that, but if you searched California State Parks off-road, off-highway vehicle, recreational, you'll find it. You go to their site and go to the Oceano Dunes SVRA and pick it up there.
PM10, that was in your slide. I don't know what that is.
Oh, particulate matter, 10 microns or less.
10 microns.
So we have two categories of PM10 that we commonly deal with. It's PM10 and PM2.5. 2.5 is even more dangerous than 10. It's a subset of PM10. It's even smaller. So PM10 is like a human hair size, fraction or smaller than a human hair, and PM2.5 fraction is even, 25% of that.
Okay.
If I had my PowerPoint up, I could show you the slide on that. I had some extra slides.
No, I got it there.
They were emergency backup slides.
I like that slide anyway better. It tells the story, I think, because your words, if I think I heard you say it, was, this is as bad as Beijing.
During the peak...
Yeah.
Peak time periods.
So is the role of, bear with me, I'm kind of ignorant in this one because I don't live near that area. APD's role has been to be aware and monitor and set up these stations to detect that we have some very serious air pollution there. So one solution is stop the vehicles from running in the sand dunes. That's put very simplistically. But what does State Park say in return? You present this data to them, what do they say?
Well, their mandate is to provide recreation. So, and that's what they do.
Okay. And your role in your department is to measure the air quality in our county.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that.
And to attain it. And to develop regulation to attain it. And that's why we've developed a rule. I wish that it was proceeding faster.
Yeah.
However, this is a great big complicated beast of a process.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you mentioned that when vehicles drive on the beach and the wind blows, it's not necessarily the fact that the vehicles are there. So if the vehicles weren't there and the wind was blowing, would we get the silicone dust, or did the vehicles stir up the silicone dust and then when the wind blows, it carries it?
What happens is that the vehicles change the vegetation and the shape of the dunes themselves. So the sand moves at a much lower wind speed to try to basically level itself back out. So you can remove the vehicles and it would probably emit, like if you shut it down for a month, probably stabilize and emit a lot less. Then you brought them back in and you started making different ridges and things, and they probably come back to the same amount in short order. So
it's the vehicles that either change the dunes or stir up
changing
the sand.
Changing the surface, and yeah.
Okay.
And there is a theory that there is some crushing from the vehicles on top of the sand versus sand. We haven't had any way to prove that on a level, any kind of a level. However, the saltation process of sand moving against sand as it bounces along, as a grain of sand will bounce along, edges will come off of the grain of sand and then get emitted into the air as a fine particulate. That's the primary method of saltation or emission generation, is that movement of sand. And the area where it's actively ridden on, the sand moves at much, much greater and much lower speeds. So, okay. And compared to the dune preserve just right to the north, or to the closed riding area just to the south, you take a sheet of bare sand, put 20 miles an hour of wind on it, you won't get hardly anything moving off of the northern side or the southern side of bare sand, but in the middle where the riding is, it's moving.
Okay.
And little pieces are being bounced off each edge of each grain of sand.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Gary. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments? Questions? Thank you very much for coming and presenting this.
Sorry I had to bore you with so much detail. I wanted to spark your interest and get you to ask some questions, but
Needed to educate us, and I believe that you did that without a doubt.
All right, thank you.
Okay. So any other comments on this evening's topic? We will invite public comment. Each speaker is limited to 3 minutes. If you'll please give us your name before you begin.
Thank you. My name is Paul Stoltman. I live on the Mesa. And today, what I'd like to say is that based on new data coming out of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, part of the Department of Labor, I think we're underestimating the health effects that we're suffering from on the dunes. You mentioned silica. The department, OSHA, let's call it OSHA. OSHA just came out with a new standard for workplace exposure, 8-hour standard, not the 24-hour health standard that, you know, California has that I think Gary indicated we're violating 60 to 80 times a year. If you look at those spikes last about 8 to 10 hours. OSHA just came out with workplace exposure limits for silica dust, and most of the dust we're exposed to is silica, 60 to 80% of the dust. They just set a limit of 50 micrograms per cubic meter for an 8-hour exposure for workers, not sensitive old folks like us or young people in our schools, workers, theoretically healthier types of individuals. If, I think Gary indicated, we're exceeding the state health standard, which is 50 micrograms per cubic meter over 24 hours, about 60 times a year or so. If you look at the data, the these spikes that happen, I haven't done a complete analysis, but I think you're going to find that every year we have 8-hour exposures over 50 micrograms, probably 100 to 150 times a year. Because most of the days, even when we don't violate the state standard, many of those days we will have spikes that will go up over 100 micrograms per cubic meter. And invariably, the wind comes up at 8 or 9, 10 in the morning and dies down at 6, 7 in the evening. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, that's when we're out exercising. We're out there, you know, playing golf, playing tennis, riding our bikes, et cetera. So the health consequences of what that dust is doing to us, I believe, is being seriously underestimated. Now, Gary was nice enough to say that they're concerned about these peak exposures. But in setting this new standard, OSHA spent multiple years looking at the new health data, that the more recent health data and epidemiology and lab studies, and I think has clearly come to the conclusion that, at least for silica, which is what we're primarily exposed to, there needs to be a tightening of that standard and a recognition of the health consequences. So it goes beyond, with silica, unfortunately, goes beyond impacts on the lung. There are also implied impacts on the kidneys. There are impacts on the immune system. As with any fine particle, impacts on cardiovascular systems and such things as COPD and others, the lung systems. But I think I would suggest that you take a look at the new health standards that just came out from OSHA, take a look at the health studies that back that up, and help us make a case to the APCD, which is a health agency. It is not just a monitoring agency. They are there to protect our health. And they need input from you guys that there's a serious health issue there. In this case, somewhat unique related to these peaks of silica dust that are a significant concern. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Michael Young. I watch the Mesa from my backyard every single day. We can see the ocean, we can see all the dust plumes that come off. I think Paul has actually understated the danger and the amount of dust that we get. Take one example. If you get a single day with a 600 microgram per cubic meter exceedance in an hour, as has happened, that's the equivalent of 12 days of exceedance. 600 divided by 50 is 12. So a single, that still counts as a single day, even though it's 600 versus 50. Okay? That's what's going on. It's many, many more. I thought you were a little generous, Paul, by saying it's only 100, 150. It's probably more like 200 or 300. Could be even more than 365 if you did the math right. The other thing, the question was asked about what warnings are given. The notifications that are giving, the green, the yellow, and the red warnings to say how dangerous it is, use three stations and the average of the three stations. The three stations are the Cal Fire station, which is the one that receives the most dust. The second one being Mesa 2, which is at a little south of Via Concha and Route 1, right adjacent to the Trilogy property and downwind of Phillips. And the third one is 5 miles to the east. That's in downtown Napomo. That one is so far away, it gets very little. You saw it on the graphs. It's about a third or so of the CDF site. Is that correct? Around that number. So you're averaging a very low number with the higher numbers, which is where the population is. The population at Cypress Ridge, the population at Black Lake, the population at Monarch Dunes, which is going to 1,300 houses, and all the houses in between. So the greatest concentrations are actually being understated by the warning signals that are given, because it incorporates that station that's so far away. And the other thing about whether it's the dust would be there if it was the ordinary wind or whether it's exacerbated by the vehicles, I think that's indisputable because there's one other station. It's the station at Osoflaco that was put in a year ago, and that station is in a vegetated area. Sometimes it gets much more wind than any of the other sites, and still it has essentially nominal dust. It's background level dust. And that's all it takes. All it takes is a little bit of vegetation brought back the way it was before the county allowed the dune buggies and other things to destroy the vegetation on the LeGrand track. And it's the county's responsibility, it would seem to me, to protect the safety and health of its residents by allowing that track to be returned to its natural state and not to allow the vehicles to run over its property. This is not the state's property. It's not the vehicular property. It's the county's property. It's the county's fault here. Thank you.
Rochelle Todi, Concerned Citizens for Clean Air. And as I said in the public comment, I really would appreciate the opportunity to provide you a lot more information, which we have, on why this is all occurring. But for this evening, I'm just going to quickly make some comments on the APCD presentation. And then I brought some slides and that will be more illuminating than what you've already seen. Concerning the PM2.5, we have been talking about PM10 for the majority of the evening, but last year we were in non-compliance with the federal 2.5 standard for the annual standard. The temporary mitigation targets the CDF site. So if that line going down is created by anything, it could be the fact they've just piled up hay bales in front of the monitor at CDF. The last letter I sent to you showed the map of how they've arranged that mitigation. And the mitigation that would be least expensive and easiest to do, according to Desert Research Institute, would be to plant vegetation and stop disturbing the sand dunes. But that's being ignored by the APCD, the state parks, CARB, et cetera. We take issue with 3 years of temporary mitigation, which the APCD has agreed to in these meetings, that continually targets the CDF site. The control monitor at Osoflaco is 7 to 10 times lower than the CDF site, as the gentleman before me said. The EIR is inadequate, and we should not be applauding them for giving us a 5-year plan where they plan to plant possibly 100 acres of vegetation, not necessarily in an emissive area, perhaps outside the riding area. Getting another temporary permit for 2017, again, not acceptable. And we have had about 30 dust rule violations this year for which no action is being taken, which I've mentioned before. So those are some of the issues we have. I'm sorry, Jean, can you bring up the first slide, which would be the U.S. probably PM map? This is a map of the United States for 2012. I can't quite read the date, but you can see the one little orange spot on the coast of California, one of the highest readings in the whole country on that hour of that day. And the next slide, which is going to be dunes versus riding area. This is a photograph of where the fence line is. This is taken in La Grande track, I believe, and you can clearly see what disturbed sand looks like compared to natural sand. And the next one, please. It's another photograph of riding area versus non-riding area. And then next is a Coastal Commission slide presentation, which I showed 2 years ago to the Coastal Commission. The Coastal Commission is responsible for monitoring the management of this park and controlling intensity of use. Go ahead. You can just start with figure one, two, three, go all the way down Coastal Commission presentation. I'll give you a little narrative for each photograph. This is an aerial shot showing each monitor site, CDF, Mesa 2, and then NPR is the Napomo Regional Park. Okay, there should be another one. I have three aerial photographs. Okay, I believe that's one you've already seen. At the bottom it says from something Willow Road and Highway 1 looking to the southwest. Okay, and this is another aerial image where you can see the plume going across. The plume extends 12 miles into Santa Maria. Yep, go ahead, you can go to the next one. We're having technical difficulties. That's the map which Gary already showed you. So that's approximately where the plume is. Next. Okay, and that's the wind direction and how it hits the CDF monitor in Mesa 2. Next. Uh-huh, and that shows the direction of the prevailing wind, and that big bare area where there used to be vegetation is La Grande Track. And at the top, you see, you'll see another one. You can see the vegetation going from the top down, and then it ends because that's where the riding area starts. And then at the bottom up, you can see the vegetation, what's called four dunes, which is what's missing from La Grande Track and the rest of the park. Mm-hmm. This is a photo of the crust, which I don't think Gary actually said, but the reason the sand doesn't move in non-riding area, which is still sand, is there is a crust. And I think that photograph was taken by APCD, wasn't it?
It might have been.
Yeah, because it's in one of your reports. Next. This was also in an APCD report. This was the previous riding area in 1979, when, as he said, there was riding allowed up and down the whole Central Coast, practically. Next, this is what happened. Oh, no, that was not it. The next one is the photograph with the vegetation. Yeah, that's what it looks like now. There's the current riding area. There's a fence line around it. And wherever there's outside the fence area, there's vegetation. Okay, next. The map, that's it. Okay, so you see this map. The gray area is where vegetation used to be, but now it's gone. And were that vegetation there and the four dunes, there could still be riding in this park, but it would probably resolve this issue. And they've known this for many, many years. Okay, next. This is part of the Coastal Commission permit that says vegetation, whether fenced or unfenced, is off limits to riding. Next. Only a couple more. This is a photo of vegetation and the fencing. And the permit also says the fencing is to be kept 100 feet away from the vegetation. However, I've seen numerous locations, I took this photograph, where the vegetation is going through. And it was actually alleged years ago to the Sierra Club that park employees may be spraying the vegetation with Roundup to keep it from getting outside the fence. Next. There should be a couple more. No? Okay. Well, I think we got the majority of the information to you, and I would really appreciate having more time in the future. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for all your comments.
I believe what we will do at this point is we will discuss among ourselves what it is that we think we can do or might do, and I think that perhaps we may actually have to form a little work group or something to study all of the information in that, but we will take into account all the stuff that has been said to us, the comments that were made tonight, and the report that we received, and you will certainly hear something from us. Thank you all for being here this evening. With that, let's move on to our next agenda item, which is Dr. Borenstein's health agency report.
Thanks. Good evening. So I am going to go from dust to mosquitoes. I had been asked at our retreat to give an update on what the status of Zika virus is and risks to our community in particular, but in the larger community in the United States. So I'm going to just spend a few minutes on that topic. So clinically, I'm sure some of this will be old news for many of you, but I'm going to give a very broad brush on what we're talking about related to the Zika virus. So it is a virus. It was originally identified in the late 1940s in Central Africa, Uganda specifically, and seemed to be quiescent until about 2007, when the first large outbreak was noticed in areas of Pacific Islands. And then it emerged again in 2015 in Latin America. Brazil has been the largest area, largest number of cases, but it is now in 50 different countries and U.S. territories in the world, continuing to spread, apparently. The disease itself is fairly non-threatening for the average person, a person of any age. 80% of people who become infected have no signs or symptoms whatsoever. The other 20% have more of a flu-like illness. They may have fever, rash, joint pain, or conjunctivitis, which is red eyes, or all of the above together. But again, only about 1 in 5 people experience the symptoms. The thing that obviously has been capturing everyone's attention and grave concern is that even absent symptoms, infection in pregnant women can lead to significant and severe conditions in the fetus and in the infant at birth, particularly microcephaly, which is small head, accompanied with a small brain and considerable developmental disabilities. But also there are emerging other findings like calcium lesions in the brain, other types of brain defects and disabilities that more information is still coming out on. But the thing that has been proven now to be linked is the microcephaly to Zika virus infection in a pregnant woman. We also have seen some cases of a rare condition known as Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurologic condition that can cause either short-term mild to moderate or longer-term and or severe muscle paralysis, and can in rare cases even lead to death. To my knowledge, as of today, there have been 2 deaths associated with Zika virus in elderly persons, and it's unclear whether or not the Zika infection was coincidental to their demise or in some way contributory. So that's the clinical picture. Obviously, the birth defects is what we're most worried about, and it is the first time ever that there has been a vector-borne or mosquito-borne, in this case, cause of a birth defect. And it has been about 50 years since we have had a viral cause of birth defects. The last time that came to light was with German measles or rubella. Sorry. So the epidemiology, as I said, there's about 50 countries that have been impacted by this. That includes Puerto Rico and the United States Virgin Islands. In those countries in the world, there have been about 5,500 cases in total and about 500, in just the U.S. territories, this is. Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands have had about 5,500 cases and about 500 pregnant women who have been tested positive. In the United States, that number stands at about under 2,000, 1,800 plus, and about 480 of those are in pregnant women. These numbers are thought to be much lower than the actual number of people infected because, again, most people are not symptomatic, and there is no recommendation for testing for otherwise healthy individuals who are not either themselves pregnant or their sexual partner's pregnant or planning to be pregnant in the near future. So again, the number of cases is probably considerably higher. In California, there have been 114 cases reported to date, 21 in pregnant women. And as of Friday, the state did a press release indicating that there have been 2 births with microcephaly in California babies. I do not know the status of the other 19 diagnosed pregnant women, but I suspect we will hear of additional cases going forward. SLO County, we have not had any reports in our residents, but we have done testing on dozens of individuals, to date, of the California's 58 counties, 22 have had at least one case diagnosed. So how is it transmitted? It is largely, the vast majority of these cases are transmitted through the bite of an infected mosquito, and it's a particular kind of mosquito, which I'll talk about in a moment. But we do know that there have been a number of cases in the, you know, low teens that have been identified as sexual transmission being the only means of exposure. And that initially was thought to be only from men, males to females, but now there have been at least a couple of cases of females to males. So it seems to be able to, the virus to reside in sexual fluids and tissues and infect in both directions. Obviously from mother to fetus is an important means of transmission. And bloodborne transmission is, we have not seen any blood donations be the cause of infection, but there has been one lab worker who was infected by handling of blood with Zika virus. It is not transmitted by casual contact. It is not thought to be, it is not known to be transmitted by air or droplet nuclei or flu, any of the typical ways that most of our common viruses are transmitted. So in addition to the international cases that I reported and even the U.S. territories, there have now been 16 cases of local transmission identified in Florida in the Miami area. Of those, 2 were isolated incidents and thought to not go further than the one individual who had no travel history but became infected. But 13 of the others were part of a cluster where it was thought to be going from mosquito to person to mosquito to person. And the status of that, whether a transmission has been stopped, is unknown at this time, but they're really focusing on a one-mile area of people who've been found to be infected who had no travel history. So the concern, obviously, is, well, are we just going to be the next country on the list who are experiencing in the thousands of cases and then potentially hundreds of pregnant women with the disease and at risk for their fetuses? It actually is not that easy to create a situation of local transmission, and here's why. So the individual who's infected carries the virus in their blood for only a week or less. So the individual, in order to give the virus to a local mosquito, that mosquito has to bite the infected person within that 3, 5, 7 day period of them carrying the virus. Then you have to have the right mosquito in the community, which we believe that we do not, but I'll get back to that in a moment about what we're doing. The particular species of mosquito is called the Aedes mosquito. There's a couple of subspecies that are thought to carry this virus. They are the same that carry dengue fever, yellow fever, and chikungunya. Those are the other significant diseases that are carried by this particular mosquito. Once you have that mosquito and an infected person and a bite takes place, the mosquito needs a 10-day period for the virus to get to the salivary glands of the mosquito. The average mosquito of this species lives for only 14 days. So in order for the mosquito to have enough time, they have to be less than 4 days old, basically, for that mosquito to be able to transmit to some other person. And then they have to find a new host who's not infected and bite that person, and then that person needs to become infected in that short window of time. So those are the conditions for establishing even a single person-to-mosquito-to-person transmission. Why that it has been happening in other places and not yet in the U.S. In any great numbers is a product of a number of things. Our living conditions are such that we don't have as many mosquitoes of this type. Where they exist, they're even fewer in number than in other parts of the world. We don't live as closely, and we live largely in homes that are screened, so we don't have as ready access to the mosquitoes as, you know, hundreds of millions of people do on a daily basis in parts of the world where they're not living in screened homes and air-conditioned conditions. And also we've had some advance warning and the opportunity for very aggressive response on the first notice of local transmission. So it remains to be seen what it will mean in the continental U.S., but thus far we've had modest impact, both from travel association infection as well as local transmission. So what is being done in general terms is obviously surveillance for the mosquitoes and surveillance for disease. So in Slo County, we are entering into contracts with neighboring counties who do have mosquito control districts to bring our surveillance up to date. The last time that this county did widespread mosquito surveillance was when we had a vector program, and that ended in 2009. So as a first step, we're at least trying to make sure that we stay on top of the identification of the mosquitoes that we do have in this county, and not just blithely assume that because we didn't find them a number of years ago that they have not become present in our county. The nearest place that there are this particular species of mosquitoes is Kern County, but we do not see it to the north or the south where there have been mosquito control programs in place, so that's good news. Education, obviously, is very important. We've been trying very much with, you know, the State Health Department, CDC, World Health Organization to get the message out loud and clear. If you are a pregnant woman, do not travel if you can avoid it in any way to a country where the Zika virus is endemic. if you must travel, take great precaution to not be exposed to mosquitoes that bite. That could be in the form of insecticides, wearing, you know, long pants clothing, staying indoors as much as possible for these daytime biting mosquitoes, and stay in places that either have windows or screens that are intact. If you have a sexual partner, a male who has traveled, and your partner is pregnant, the advice is to avoid sex during the entirety of the pregnancy, and to avoid getting pregnant for either 8 weeks post-travel for individuals who do not know themselves to have been bitten and were not symptomatic, or up to 6 months to wait for conception if the male has been symptomatic. We've been trying to get the word out with our healthcare providers, working particularly with obstetricians so that they know all this kind of information and what kind of testing needs to be done and when. There are different, whether you're looking for the actual virus, that has to be done in the very beginning, a short period of time. If you're looking for the antibodies to show that there was recent infection, that's at a different time. So we're working very closely with particularly the OBs to get that information out. And as I said, we are testing in this county, and for those for whom it is recommended, we're sending those specimens to the state laboratory, who are working diligently to turn a very large volume of specimens around with test results in a short period of time. So with that, I am open to any questions.
Yeah, could you clarify, Dr. Borenstein, you said that a person that might have the virus then gets bitten by a mosquito. I thought the mosquito had to induce the virus in a person. That's not right?
Yes, it is right. So, okay. But the way the next mosquito becomes infected is from the infected person's blood.
Okay,
take a blood meal off of you.
Okay.
An infected individual. Process it, have the virus make its way to their salivary glands over this 10-day period, and then bite the next non-immune person and start the cycle again.
Thank you.
I'm glad we asked you to do that. That was very informative.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm going to end my report with that. I have nothing that can supersede it or that's pressing, so I will
thank you
turn it back
much.
Over to you. Thanks.
So let's see what we have for commissioner updates. Start at my left. David?
Scott mentioned that we'll be giving a report to the commission next month about our review of the Ag Department, which has been very comprehensive. So we'll try and give a pretty brief report, giving you the results of what we found.
Okay. We'll excuse you this time tomorrow. Susan?
Yes, with the Homeless Services Oversight Committee that I sit on, particularly the Housing Committee, there is an opportunity for the community to have a speaker, either Ann Wyatt or Jerry Ryu from the Housing Trust Fund will come out to service organizations or senior groups or anybody that might be interested in some of the new housing options we're looking at, such as home sharing and tiny houses. They've got a wonderful PowerPoint presentation, and they're really trying to get out into the community. So that's the first one. The next thing is that that group is The Homeless Services Oversight Council is sponsoring what they're calling a MASH event, and there will be one in South County, I believe, the August 30th, and another one in North County on October 30th, and that's when they bring a whole range of services together for the homeless members in the community. They can come into that one spot and get everything from licenses for their dogs to driver's licenses to getting signed up for other social service programs, finding out about substance use disorder opportunities. It's just a wonderful, wonderful day. I participated in the first one last year in Paso, and there were over 81 people that showed up at that first event. And lunch was provided, and they actually had a couple drawings for bicycles, which were incredibly well received. And just a very good all-around event. So I'm glad to see they're doing that again and expanding it this year to South County. And the other thing I wanted to bring up, which has to do with this, is tomorrow morning in here in the Board of Supes chambers, they're going to be determining if this county is going to participate in what's called the 1115 waiver for Medi-Cal provision of substance use disorder services in this county. And it would be a wide range of services that will be paid for people who are on Medi-Cal. And we have not had that in this county, and it's everything from detox to residential. It's California's a pilot program, and each county gets to decide whether they're going to opt in or not, and I certainly hope our supervisors are going to opt in. We have not had any of these kinds of services in our county ever, and I think that would save a lot of lives and money. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The California Healthcare Foundation approved a 2.5-year project to develop an electronic registry for the physician order for life-sustaining treatment, which is the PULSED. And it's going to be started as a pilot project in both San Diego and Contra Costa counties. What that means is that they will be working on putting an electronic way of statewide to have a pulsed form that people can register so that physician offices, EMS, hospitals, California-wide will be able eventually to access that rather than people having to carry their pulsed form with them. California is only the third state to have what's considered a mature pulsed program out of, we have 47 states that use either a pulsed or a mulsed, but we've really advanced with the pulsed program. So it's got great implications for individuals to make choices for their health care, especially when they can't make decisions because of their physical status. We should be hearing a lot more about that. And that's it.
I have a couple of things. Just in follow-up, I wanted you all to know that, remember at the retreat we talked as part of your community education plan for the commission that we would do a letter to the Board of Supervisors letting them know what some of our upcoming programs were and asking them for some comments about what health issues might be important for them. So Gene and I are working on that letter. By probably next week, we should get it out to everyone. Claire, who isn't with us this evening because of her back surgery, did make contact with the GPS people, I believe, the television. What is it? Typo, Mary Jean, AGP people. And they promised to get the web numbers for us, but they said there was no way to track or find out what the TV viewership might be. But they could get the web numbers, and they'll work on that for us. Then for my committees, I did go to the meeting they had on CalFresh and how we might increase food access. As Dr. Bornstein had mentioned last time, our county for some reason has a fairly low rate of participation from those that are eligible. We're only like at 39%. It was a very well-attended meeting, actually. The room was entirely full. There must have been between 35 and 40 people there. Supervisor Gibson was there representing the Board of Supervisors, as well as other stakeholders. And our speaker, who was the chief of the CalFresh branch, we accessed her remotely. We had a couple of technical problems, but it all worked out actually very well. She does expect to be in the county sometime soon and promised to work with everyone on increasing that rate of participation. It appears that most other counties allow people to totally sign up without doing an in-person interview, which is something that we apparently require in this county. And there was some thought about whether that was a deterrent or not. So that is a work in progress. The Oral Health Coalition, which I went to for Claire last week, had a very active meeting. And just to bring you up to date on a couple of things, because I think we will be hearing from them, there was a successful, it was called a Hope Clinic, held in Templeton, which is an organization from Southern California, I believe, that came in, saw patients for a day. It was sponsored by the Adventist Church up there. It was a full day from 8 to 6, where they saw patients all day long. This organization brings their own equipment, including the chairs. They did root canals, they did fillings, they did all kinds of things. So they asked people to make appointments, which they did. They were able to accommodate some walk-ins as well, and they didn't quite have all the numbers pulled together to know exactly how many they served. But it was a successful day. They do expect to do it at least one more time this year. They'd like to do it on a twice a year basis. Just one of the comments from one of the local dentists is they'll hopefully work in conjunction with the local dental society a little more next time, just to inform and let the dentists know that they're going to be in the community and where they can send some people. Also, the big thing from the Oral Health Coalition is, you know, we have this money that's become available, and actually I brought a couple of little press release type handouts for everybody. The $740 million over a five-year period, that's part of the Dental Transformation Initiative. There are basically four domains that they're looking at to help us bring our dental health system up to date and allow more people to participate in that. The first domain is preventive care, and there is an incentive payment for providers who see patients ages 0 to 20 and provide some preventive care that's in place. There's a domain two is a caries assessment. It carries risk assessment. They're developing a tool. They will be training and certifying a dentist who will then receive, again, an incentive who provide these services for patients. Domain three is the continuity of care domain, and San Luis Obispo County has been, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Penny, but San Luis Obispo County has been selected as one of 17 counties to participate in this domain. And again, there's a bonus payment to providers if a patient goes back for care or is seen within a year's time, and if they get paid the dental cal rate for the service they provide, and then there's an incentive of about $40 per patient on top of that. Domain four is the local dental pilot project, and this domain allows for 15 organizations, and I'm not sure if an organization is considered a county, but our organization is one here, that will receive some additional funds to incorporate all of the domains of this whole DTI initiative. So Kathleen is writing it's a grant process, and so she'll be writing the grant. She will likely be coming to the Health Commission to ask us for a letter of support, because that's an important part of the grant. So just so you know, there are four components that she's looking at. The first is a pilot project to do what would be considered a virtual dental office. It's between the Tolosa Clinic and the Shandon Elementary School, where they plan to put one hygienist out in the school one day a week, and she will be able to do some... Kathleen will tell us what she will be able to do, but I think it's preventive and some possible, there's some kind of new kind of a filling that they might be able to do. But it's an interesting project, and Penny, you probably know more about that than I.
Would you like me to save you here?
Please. Thanks.
Indeed, Kathleen is probably going to do a fair bit of the writing of the proposal, but it is really what's exciting about it is it is coming out of the Oral Health Coalition that this county formed in probably 2010, thereabouts. It was an offshoot of a First Five investigation that had been going on for a number of years about the level of dental care problems that we have, particularly in our children. And so the county has now taken over the responsibility for the coordination of efforts to work on access to dental care, preventive dental care, education, et cetera. The state, as part of the same 1115 waiver that Commissioner Warren mentioned with respect to the drug Medi-Cal option, one of the five major projects that the state has developed is this dental transformation initiative. I'm going to take the opportunity to go on record that this is in place of doing, which would fix the problem in my mind, is raising the Dentical rates. So dentists don't participate, private dentists in Dentical, because they get paid far lower than their cost to provide care. So I respect the state's approach, which is, well, let's see what we can do if we throw out a whole bunch of money, $740 million, to come up with new ideas about how to make dental care more available. But I don't mind being outspoken on this and saying, well, I know what I would do with $740 million is just bring more dentists in by paying them their what they need to just break even. Anyway, having said that, indeed these four components exist. Only two are available to us. The first three domains were based on state data as to which counties were perceived to be in the best position to take advantage of each of the first three domains. The fourth domain is, in fact, a competitive grant that 15 applicants will receive, be they a region or an individual county. Only local counties, tribal areas, and University of California campuses can apply. We are hopeful, given that only 18 letters of support were submitted, letters of intent, but there was no requirement for that, that perhaps we'll be in good shape. And what this county has, we've come together to work on a multifaceted proposal. And one of the components is, and when I first heard this, as did many people, said, how do you do virtual dentistry? But the idea is that dentists are in short supply, especially in our public or nonprofit system. And if and Tolosa is going to run with this component of the project, is if you can get a dental hygienist to go into a community that has issues with transportation and issues with access, and bring the services to them for at least providing those service elements that are within the scope of a dental hygienist. They can also take information while they're there, be it x-rays, be it limited exam findings, and send those to a dentist who can then say, okay, well, based on this report and based on the x-ray findings, here's what I think this child needs. And the hygienist can actually go back and do some interim fillings. They can apply a new technology, silver diamine fluoride, that can actually arrest the cavity at its current stage. So it sort of buys time in a sense. So that is one aspect of the program. Another thing that has come to light, or the proposal, is that there are not enough registered dental assistants in our county, a lot of people go through school and become a dental assistant, but they do not take that next step to get their licensure as registered dental assistants. And what that does is prevents them from doing some things that would, again, create more opportunity for care in their hands, taking the pressure off the dentist. So what we have learned is that the reason that people stop at the DA as opposed to RDA is the $600 fee for that licensure. So we are going to propose at a minimum to provide the cost of the actual exam to get people to over that hump and to be able to expand the services that they can provide. We're also talking about working, you know, with Cuesta to see if they might bring a program online, and whether tuition support would also expand the complement of registered dental assistants available. And the third component, which is very exciting, is working both directly with private dentists and through CHC to get dentists to take on a certain number of DentaCal patients in their private practice, be paid either through us, through this grant with incentive money, or through a contract with CHC, who has a higher rate of pay by virtue of their federal healthcare status. And so that part of the plan is emerging, but we are hopeful that we will, we already believe there are a few dentists who are willing, and we'd like to get as high as 10 dentists. And by distributing the DentaCal patient load across a larger number of dentists, then perhaps 100 patients out of a 2,000 patient practice will not be that much of a financial disincentive. And so to support community dentists through this 5-year project by doing case management, making sure the patients show up, making sure the patients know what's expected at the dental visit, and providing the follow-up education and cares, working in that partnership as a way to try to gently ease in the patients across a number of community dentists. So that grant keeps getting postponed because of some state and federal approval issues, which is great for us, although I hope it doesn't create more applicants by virtue of the delay, but it gives us more time to flesh out some of these ideas. And so now it was originally supposed to be due August 1st, then mid-August, and now it's September 30th. So thank you.
Good, you did save me. Good job. So I Kathleen will probably, or somebody, come and ask.
Program manager.
But I'm sure we'll, since that's kind of a follow-up issue for us from the presentation that we had, that we will certainly likely support it and be willing to do a letter of support. I have only one last thing, and that's from Heal Slow, just to remind you that we're having the 10th anniversary Heal Slow conference on Friday, October the 7th. I know it's a ways off, but it is 8:30 to 2:30. It will be at the Mountain Brook educational auditorium, I think it is. It's the auditorium at the church up by the TV station. The program has been set. Our key speakers, there will be two. One is Dr. Aitan, who's Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, and then Roe Hayden-Smith, who's from UC Cooperative Extension. She's going to talk about from Victory Gardens to Urban Farms. There are several other things planned for the day, one of which is a rather novel idea. It's called Veggie Box Presentations. They're short little presentations from anyone that that has a product or a service or anything that does with healthy living. It's competitive. They will have these little short presentations throughout the day, and then at the end of the day, there will be voting, and there will be an award presented. And I think Kathleen said the award, we're looking at $1,000 reward to be presented to all that. But should be a good event. Assemblyperson Asajian has agreed to come and recognize the original Heal Slow work group or task force. So that is October again. And that's it for me. Any other things from commissioners? David.
This group that came tonight, this Concerned Citizens for Clean Air, and the letter that Rochelle gave us, they're expecting something from us, and so there's a lot of items on this list of 10 items that she suggested that we could help with. I'm sure there's some of those that we can't get involved in, but how are we going to handle that is, I guess, what I'm concerned about.
Well, I'm certainly open to hearing from all of you. My thought would be, because there is so many things there, David, that we might want to do a small work group or committee or something to kind of flush out what is it we can really do or what can we support. I don't know how the rest of you feel about it. I would like to hear from you, actually. Scott?
Well, I felt like part of the story. So we got APD's side of the story, and I felt the other part we're not hearing is the state parks. I think we were inviting them. True? Did they get invited?
I don't think so. It was too quick for
to get. So, yeah, I'd like to hear state parks. And the other one, I'd like to hear from some medical professionals about what does this particulate stuff do. I think Commissioner Campbell was sort of focusing in that direction of, do we have any solid statistics or something that can show what's happening in our community? And I know Dr. Bornstein spoke to that a little bit at our retreat, that it's hard because we're small population community in ways. It's hard to say there's a perfect study. Well, I know there was no perfect study out there. But it seems like, yeah, we need to hear a couple more others in giving us input on it. Yeah, because I thought it's interesting what APD brought. I got more educated that way. The Concerned Citizens, they've got some very valid concerns there. Trying to figure out, but I like the work group idea. Take it to our community education group, but do we need to hear maybe first publicly from, as I suggested, state parks or medical professionals? I don't mean or, I mean and. So that we get a little more well-informed. And when we look at her laundry list of action items she'd like, I think almost all of them we don't do.
Right.
Right. We know what our mission is, and we're more to be advisory to the Board of Supervisors. I think she's got great ideas on here. These are things that need to happen, but not from us. But still, I'd like to see if there's enough interest in this commission to move ahead with this, of trying to get it to, like the Community Education Committee to study it a little more.
Okay. David?
Yeah, I'd be willing to be part of a committee that would look into this further. And as Scott suggested, maybe getting some input from the parks and maybe from the medical people might help too. But I think when we look at this list, like Scott said, when I looked at it, it was things that, we can write a letter to the Board of Supervisors and recommend something, but some of this stuff is beyond our scope. A lot, most of it.
Sure. Agree. Okay. Tamar?
I am new.
We threw you to the fire tonight.
Yeah. I am a bit new at this, and I know that there has been an extensive history in not only researching this, but also presenting it to the Health Commission at various times. I guess the only sort of comment I would make is that it's clear that the Health Commission will need to address it in some way, as it is, in fact, a community health issue. I think perhaps looking at our role and knowing that this is an issue that exists and essentially really only looking at it in that perspective as opposed to the asks, the particular asks perhaps, knowing what we, where our boundaries lie as a commission, and are there things that we can do, perhaps not necessarily focusing on the particular things that were outlined, but rather sort of on a larger perspective of.
Good thoughts. Thank you. Chris?
I agree. I don't know that this body is a body to make any decisions for any kind of conclusions or that's not what we do. I do think that the fact that it came to a health commission because it's a health concern for people is what I wouldn't want to see is that we don't do anything.
Right.
So I think within the scope of what we can do, if nothing other than just saying this is something that's still on the table, it's still a concern and it's an unresolved concern that has been kind of that kick the can that needs to be looked at. If nothing other than that, I think we're doing what we need to be doing.
Good. Okay. Susan?
Yes, I feel that since the draft EIR report is out there, that we definitely need to have somebody from Parks, and I think somebody from Medical to round that out. And the other one that I found interesting on here was the number 3, advocating for disclosure of air pollution in all real estate transactions of homes in the path of the plume. Well, that could be anything in this county. And, you know, I'd like to know whether that is something that needs to be done, because the State Board of Realtors, I'd like to have a representative from the Board of Realtors come in and tell us just what needs to be disclosed legally and why wasn't that disclosed to these homeowners. And I think that's something that we as a group could include that in our informational search, that it's not just about the sand and all of that blowing, but also just the disclosure.
So I think I'm hearing that there certainly is enough interest that we should do some further study here. Why don't I suggest this for those of you that would like to be on the work group or whatever, if you would let me know through Jean, then we can look at how we should proceed. Should we do work group type of thing? Should we do some additional meetings? We will certainly look for your input, Dr. Bornstein, on what to do with that. But does that sound acceptable to everyone? Okay, and we want to make sure that we include our commissioners that aren't here this evening on what we're going to do with that. Okay, so with that, have we also covered prospective future items? I think we're set for the next few months at least. I see I skipped over our committee reports. Did anybody from any of our 4 standing committees have anything to report?
I just wanted to ask something that we've got this bulletin here tonight, and in looking at this for the coccidiomycosis, and I know that one of our other members had asked if we were going to take a look at that, because in this county, we are already through June above what we had in total cases for the full year last year. And when you talk about wind blowing and everything else, I'd like to have an update on that, what's going on.
So would you like to have, should we look at a program on that? Is that what you're, or?
We had talked about bringing it in the spring, but
okay,
can certainly do it sooner.
Penny?
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall exactly what the commissioners at the retreat had laid out an agenda. I know Coxie was on it, and
right. Okay, so, well, that's okay. Fine. And yeah, with the Coxie and also maybe the Hep C at the same time, because there seems to be a pretty big number in the community for the number of Hep C cases, and maybe if we held that till the spring and find out just exactly what's out there, how people get tested, you know, what do they do when they find out they have it?
Yeah, again, I don't recall if we, I think we had talked about having someone from AIDS Support Network or possibly Dr. Taylor when she's back in the country as yeah, an expert okay, in that area.
So that will, that was a among our list of possibles.
Right, right, sure it was for gets, in the spring, but I had just noticed okay, in the public health bulletin that
okay, good,
we've all got right, high numbers.
Okay. I will just put a plug out there again for Claire and the nominating committee. We are still looking for a direct provider to fill our one vacancy here. I know a few people in the community are trying to help us out and look for someone who might be interested, but we do have that seat that we still need to fill. So with out there being any further business, I believe we're ready for adjournment for this evening. Thank you all.